Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. If you'd like to take part in our conversations on the exchange, you are more than welcome. Phone numbers again, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Or shoot an email to us, jx@jeffnet.org. We get so used to hearing about new technologies that can move us past fossil fuels, we sometimes forget how long we as a species have been trying to tap the energy of the sun. Sure, the electricity creating solar cells on the rooftops are relatively recent technology, but humans began figuring out ways to warm themselves and ease their workloads with the sun's energy a very long time ago indeed. We learned just how long ago in the book Let It Shine. John Perlin lectures extensively on forestry and solar energy in many countries. He's written some other books, including A Forest Journey, The Story of Wood and Civilization, and a previous book on the sun, From Space to the Earth, The Story of Solar Electricity. John Perlin, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks, Jeff, for having me.
Sure enough. We've been working with the sun, as we mentioned, a long time, but writing about it as well. And you make reference to this very early in your own book. Who was Charles Pope, and how long ago did he do his work?
Well, Charles Pope wrote a book which he basically stated that the only way we can get people to take solar energy seriously is to learn about the history. And so he did not have all the archival documents that fortunately I have at my beck and call, but he saw enough to know that solar energy was not something new when he wrote in 1903.
So really, at the turn of the last century, then, he was talking about this great new period of solar energy that was potentially upon us. I think he might have been surprised to find that we haven't made as much progress, or what do you think he would have thought?
Well, he would have been amazed right now at the progress we made. We're able, for example, with great efficiency, to convert sunlight directly into electricity, which is probably the most elegant technology that humankind has ever developed.
And I want to come back then to the early uses, because the book is divided up into early use and power from the sun.
Exactly. We could start. Actually, the most important invention in solar energy happened about 4,000 years ago when people devised a perpendicular stick, a stick that was perpendicular to the ground and cast a shadow. And from that, they could become calendar makers and timekeepers with scientific precision.
Just a stick?
Just a stick.
Was there a name for this in the culture of the time?
Yes, we call it the gnomon because it brings us knowledge.
Gnomon, G-N-O-M-O-N?
Right.
Interesting word. Okay, and it's called that because it brings us knowledge. But then measuring the sun was the first step, you think, toward getting us into solar power?
Not measuring the sun, but telling us where the sun was vis-a-vis human people during the year. And so we began to know that in wintertime the sun is low in the sky because it casts as long as shadow. During summertime, we know that it's high in the sky because it casts as short as shadow, and therefore it allows us to build a house that doesn't have to move to take advantage of the changing position of the sun during the year, because we can face it to the south, as the ancient Chinese did. We can have overhangs to keep the high summer sun off our house, like a hat. And in wintertime, we allow the low sun to warm us.
So the sun would actually be able to get in under the eaves because of the low angle.
Exactly, because, like, for example, in Santa Barbara, where I live, the sun is always in the ocean during the wintertime, and in the summertime, it rises. I mean, that's, you know, in relationship to our Earth, it rises in the mountains in the northeast and sets in the mountains in the northwest, very far away from the ocean.
So it was the Chinese who first made use of the sun in this way?
Exactly. They were the first who developed the gnomon, and then from the gnomon, they had perfect knowledge of how to design. First of all, they had compass knowledge. They knew north, south, east, west by the shadows. The east was gained through the afternoon sun. West was gained from the shadow cast by the morning sun. and then the solar noon cast a shadow in the north. And so then you had 3 points, and all you needed was a little bit of brain power to know that the fourth point was south.
John Perlin, your two strong suits in knowledge overlap just a bit in talking about the ancient Chinese forestry and use of the sun. And you point out in the book that the ancient Chinese had some interesting views on forestry. Tell us about those and how those figured into solar architecture.
Well, the Chinese, for some reason, were what we call obsessive-compulsive. They did not like any kind of disorder, and they thought the wilderness was disordered because you couldn't predict, right? So what they did was they, according to legend that was written thousands of years ago, the founding emperor, Yao, said, I want to get rid of this disorder. And so he had his forester burn down all the forests of China, and to his joy, everything became flat and ordered into rice fields, and there was no more wood. In fact, Mencius, a great philosopher, writes that in New Mountain there's not a tree growing, and that shows how irregular things are in our age, because on a mountain there should be trees.
Really? Wow, that's a fairly drastic way to approach forestry.
That's a drastic way to approach forestry. And so in the ensuing problem was how to heat your houses, and the only way they could do that was by depending on the sun.
All right, we'll talk about exactly how the Chinese worked their architecture into making use of the sun's rays in a little more detail. The book is called Let It Shine, The 6,000-Year Story of Solar Energy. John Perlin wrote it and revised it and expanded it recently and joins us on The Exchange. And we'll come back and talk more with John and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us to talk about the illustrious history of the use of the sun's energy on the Earth. Back here on the Jefferson Exchange with John Perlin and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John Perlin. He writes and lectures extensively on forestry and solar energy around the world. He's revised his book, Let It Shine, The 6,000-Year Story of Solar Energy, and he's our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us here at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number is 541-552-6782. And our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, John, we were talking about using the sun to heat homes in ancient China. Was it always what we now call passive solar? Was there any active solar stuff that the Chinese were able to figure out?
One of the most amazing finds of the new book, and I'd like to say it is a new book because it contains 13 new chapters with multiple discoveries of from archives throughout the world that I visited, and one of the discoveries was that the Chinese developed the first concentrating devices. That means they made concavities that could focus sunlight to get temperatures so hot that you could burn a combustible in 15 seconds.
Wow, that's interesting. So concave mirrors, basically, then.
Exactly. They were called yangsuis and soul igniters, and they were just found recently in the last 10 years. The book contains the first Western English translations of the Chinese that document this. And they were used for lighting the afternoon cooking fire.
All right. And you mentioned also that that they were used in ancient Greece as well. And it's interesting because it was just this week that they lit the Olympic torch.
Right. And in the book, I have a photograph of them doing just that. Actually, there's in the comedy of Aeschylus, a person takes a concentrating device, and he has a summons from the court, and he focuses sunlight onto it, and the summons is made from wax, so he melts and says, I don't have to go to court.
Took care of that problem.
You have to take care of that problem.
Only traffic takers are on wax now, right?
Right.
So let's go further into what the ancient Greeks are doing. There's Olynthus is mentioned in the book. And what was that? What place was that about?
Well, like the Chinese, but who did it 4,000, 6,000 years ago, the Greeks, about 2,500 years ago, listened to Socrates. Socrates was the first recorded solar advocate lecturing in Xenophon's memorabilia on how to build passively, how to build with the sun. And the Greeks followed his wisdom, and every city in Greece after 500 BC was designed so every house could take in sunlight during wintertime.
So this is fairly effective solar architecture then.
Very effective. In fact, they calculated recently that a naked Greek could stay warm throughout the day using these designs.
Interesting. So you have to assume, though, that once Rome had conquered ancient Greece, that a lot of the ideas from the Greeks ended up with the Romans. But what improvements did the Romans make upon Greek designs with solar capture?
Well, fascinating. Vitruvius, who people still study as the greatest architect of all times, was a military engineer in Greece and got to see solar cities. And what he did was he transformed the idea into the Roman Empire. But he had a more powerful materials, which was called window glass. And window glass has the interesting capability of taking in the shorter rays of the sun. But once they hit a surface, they turn into longer rays and they can't escape. And so we have accumulation of heat. We call it the greenhouse effect. They call it a heliocaminus, which means solar furnace.
Really, but windows, glass windows in Rome.
Yes, and one of the interesting things is that when I first made my study, a lot of people thought, oh, the Romans couldn't have heated their baths with the sun, right, just with window glass. So Cornell researchers built in Rome a little bath, exactly as the Romans did with glass, and they came to agree with my findings that indeed glass could keep a bath at 100 degrees Fahrenheit during the winter time and in full sunlight, and diffuse radiation when there were lots of clouds could keep it up to about 80 degrees Fahrenheit.
The large buildings you show in the book, and the book is lavishly illustrated, I should point out to the listeners thinking about latching onto a copy here. The large buildings you show do seem like they're certainly in the bigger cities, the Baths of Caracalla and things like that. Were some of these designs available to country folks, or were they living a bit of a ruder existence away from solar amenities?
Well, the most amazing thing, and I saw this as I trekked through eastern Turkey about 4 weeks ago, is that most of the Greek cities are in western Turkey where I was, and the people still build in the rural areas exactly like their ancestors did 2,500 years ago. And in fact, the rural people in China today still build as their ancestors did. So no, the rural people, kept up the tradition. In fact, we have digs from Greece where they show that it didn't matter whether it was rural or urban, everyone built with the sun.
How did the first solar ordinances or laws develop in ancient Rome? I understand that's where we began to talk about things like the right to have the sunshine on your house.
Well, sunshine was so valuable, to heat a house, that if you shaded another person's like access to the sun, they developed sunlight laws, which were recorded in what's called the Digestia by Ulpian, which is the greatest collection of Roman laws, which showed how significant it was, because only the base, most important laws were included in the Digestia.
So the idea of concentrating, you were talking about concentrators, solar concentrators, concave surfaces, mirrors, basically, to capture the sun and direct it in a different way. It seems like there was a period in history in the ancient world when scientists were kind of going crazy on the idea of mirrors. In other words, there were just a lot of them for a lot of different purposes and a lot of things that were really getting a little wild in the imagination.
Well, no. When you had the choice of making a fire by friction, which could take hours, or by sunlight, which could take seconds, you have to, if you're a reasonable person, you choose the latter, right? And I should mention that the book is primarily new, with all these discoveries and all these travels to archives. It's 13 new chapters. It's actually twice the length of the earlier book, which was called The Golden Thread. So it's basically a new book.
Okay. Lenses now, for example. We moved from beyond mirrors and got into lenses. And, of course, any kid who ever had a magnifying glass and probably found some unfortunate ant to take his wrath out on knows this trick. But when did lenses come into use for capturing sun's rays and directing it in new ways?
Well, actually, in China, lenses developed about 400 or 500 B.C. In Greece about the same time. And we actually have findings from Gotland, which is an island off Sweden, that the Vikings also used lenses for making fires. You have to understand, like, making fire was really, really hard until the discovery or invention of the match in the 19th century. So people either had to, like, guard their embers for the next day. I mean, that's how the word curfew developed. Was 8 o'clock, we covered the fire, you know, to keep the embers for the next day. Because it was really, really difficult once you lost your flame to make fire. So the lenses or the mirrors were used in the Renaissance, too, to combust materials for the evening fire. And not only were they used for fires, but they were also used in the Renaissance for soldering. In fact, the Florentine churches, that's how they did the metalwork.
Really? They'd use lenses to melt the solder?
Exactly. Leonardo writes about that. In fact, Leonardo wanted to get into the solar business, another great, and he has designs, which is included in the book, of mirrors that would have a diameter of a mile.
Wow. He was thinking big.
He always thought big.
All right. The book, yeah, that's true. That is a fair statement about Leonardo da Vinci. The book is called Let It Shine, The 6,000-Year Story of Solar Energy. John Perlin wrote it, expanded it, and added 13 chapters, as you heard, for this new edition. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number is 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Perlin.
Hi. Gosh, fascinating. I try to be like the Andes sometimes and stare at the sun to get protons. Oh, that's not a good idea. I wouldn't suggest it. But I'm thinking, on the other hand, the opposite of heating, pardon me, cooling, using nature to control temperature. I read where ancient kings would get big walls of perhaps mud or clay or brick, and keep it soaked all day with water, of course, and the evening desert winds would blow, and voila, air conditioning, which they probably learned from the termites.
Right. Thanks for the call, Jeannie. Appreciate it.
Could I answer that?
Sure, absolutely.
That's interesting, because the reason why I say 6,000-year story is because the Neolithic Chinese did exactly as your listener said, that they built into the ground the house to keep the temperature, like, mild, and they also had the windows facing south to take in the winter sun, and they also had a hat, as we would call eaves, to keep the high summer sun off. And so they actually did exactly what your listener just suggested.
John, I gather from reading Let It Shine that some of these ancient technologies were lost for a time. What kinds of things pretty much disappeared from Earth technology for a while?
Well, they were lost in the urban centers, but they continued in the rural areas. So in the urban centers, people, especially because of the church did not like using nature to... you know, the scientific ideas of using nature, they wanted people just to live in faith. And so you got these medieval areas that were terribly unhealthy and dense, and that actually stimulated a new you might say, neo-solar architecture in the Enlightenment. And in fact, the Enlightenment was the idea of liberty and justice for all, and the people who began solar architecture in the Enlightenment believed that the poor people should have as much access to the sun in wintertime as the rich people who, say, escaped to Italy to get sun. So you change your latitude for the poor by building properly.
Okay, interesting. So were they also, I mean, I have to believe they were probably noticing diseases like rickets and things that were occurring to people who weren't getting a lot of sunshine in the wintertime.
Well, it's amazing you should say that, because the person who revised solar architecture was a physician who exactly diagnosed the problem and became and wrote the first solar book in 1817 called All People Should Face Their Houses Toward the Midday Sun.
All right. What's a hot box in the context of solar power, as you tell in this book?
Well, hot box, Horace de Saussure in the 1700s decided to see how hot just glass could glass covers could make an object. So he got an insulated box, put several glass covers, held it perpendicular to the sun, and he was able to get temperatures of over 300 degrees. And what they used that box for was to show the effects of global warming in 1825.
Really? Wait, yeah. But global warming as we currently talk about global warming caused by people, increases in greenhouse gases, all that?
Exactly. In fact, they talked about industrial processes causing the atmosphere to become, although to remain transparent, to become more rigid to the heat waves. And they said, just look at Horace de Saussure's hot box and you'll see what's happening. And I would tell everyone who doesn't believe in global warming, make themselves a hot box, and they can exactly imitate what's happening with carbon dioxide and Earth and sun.
So in terms of getting into the section of the book about power from the sun, I mean, we've been talking basically about passive solar applications, well, getting more active, certainly, with lenses and mirrors and things like that. But solar motors go all the way back to Hero in ancient Greece? Hero, a name, of course.
Exactly. These folks weren't thinking of, machinery. They were thinking of toys. But these toys stimulated in the 19th century people to think of steam engines run by solar energy, which they built. And by 1914, they had a cost-competitive product, which was cheaper than fossil fuels.
And so in modern times, some of the people who picked these up were guys like Augustin Mouchot. He picked up the thread in France. So what did he do in his work with solar motors?
Well, Augustin Mouchot showed that steam engines could be possible using solar energy. He also interestingly showed that you could produce ice with solar energy, and he also showed that you could produce electricity with solar energy. So he was a great pioneer. He also provided practical devices for turning brine water into fresh water thanks to the sun. In fact, the largest use of solar energy, it was by all civilizations for thousands of years, and still today in the San Francisco Bay, you can see this large pink area, and that's where they're using solar energy to turn brine water or salt water into salt.
We've seen those pink areas on approach to San Francisco Airport. I'm sure a lot of people who are listening to us have probably seen that at some time or another. It's right there along the bay, right along San Francisco Bay.
And that's actually the largest use of solar energy even today, is that it's by Cargill, the the big ag company, and they're also a big salt company, and that's how they produce their industrial salt.
I want to come back, though, to a point. You said that Mouchot figured out that you could actually make ice using the power of the sun. This does not sound like an intuitive sort of thing to do, so how?
Well, the way he did was he turned a fluid into heat, and then you heat in the inverse way to make a runner refrigerant.
All right. So it seems like then by the time we get pretty well into the 19th century that that we knew how to do a lot of things with the sun. We got pretty far down the line in tech, basically, but it seems like a lot of these things got left behind.
Well, they didn't get left behind. They like, for example, one of the biggest things in the 19th century was the development of solar water heaters commercially. And they first spread to our golden state of California and to Oregon. With the development of discovery of natural gas, they moved to Florida. And then after the war, where the utility in Florida offered people incredibly cheap water heaters that, you know, the people who are using solar to get them off solar, the solar water heater industry did not die. It migrated to Israel, then to Cyprus, and then the rest of the world.
All right, so mostly in the United States, we tended to give these things up. And we'll find out more about the ebb and flow of solar energy and its uses in the United States and beyond. The book is called Let It Shine, The 6,000-Year Story of Solar Energy. John Perlin wrote it. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join our discussion. We'll provide phone numbers and email address once again after the break. Back with John Perlin and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John Perlin. He's the author of the book Let It Shine, The 6,000-Year Story of Solar Energy. One listener called already and wanted to know where to find the book. Yes, it is in bookstores. Yes, it is at Amazon.com. And you can talk to John Perlin about the contents of the book here on the Jefferson Exchange. 800-838-3760, our toll-free number. Our Medford Ashland local number, 541-552-6782, and our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So there's a whole chapter in the section on solar water heating, John, called A Flourishing Solar Industry. When did the solar industry peak, at least in terms of solar water heating?
Oh, the solar water heater industry is still peaking. In China, there's 60 million, and it's we'll probably have 100 million installations by the end of the year. So if it only peaked in America, we have to keep, and that's what I try to give as a global perspective. Ironically, U.S. inventors developed most of the devices used today, but they're mainly used abroad.
And you point out that there were times in history when the U.S. federal government provided some seed money here. When was that, and how long did that last? And for that matter, why did it stop?
Well, actually, to get to solar cells, which we call solar panels today, they were invented. The efficient solar panels were invented 60 years ago at Bell Laboratories, and they went up on a satellite called the Vanguard in 1958, and immediately. ARPA, which is now DARPA, saw the military value and took over the whole military satellite program. And we had a strange schizophrenia in America where the military was and is gung-ho on solar, and the civilian government has been very retrograde.
Why do you suppose that is? I mean, it seems like a lot of things that have come to enhance the workings of the military at some point, or military or space program for that matter, come to enhance life for just folks or regular consumers. So is the military keeping some stuff on solar developments for itself that we don't get to have access to?
No, it's the fact that the American government, because of the Cold War, developed what was called the Atoms for Peace program. We were considered the bad guy for starting overhead testing, and overhead testing that went awry. And so the only way we could gain good, PR was to say the atom could be used for good and for bad. And we developed this Atoms for Peace program where the government focused all its money on nuclear power. And we might say solar got totally left in the shade.
Overhead testing. When you say overhead testing, you're talking about nuclear weapons testing.
Exactly.
Exploding bombs in the atmosphere.
Okay. Exactly. And in the South Pacific, in Intiwak, it went awry, and some tragedy happened. And the only way we could whitewash the tragedy was develop in a gung-ho manner nuclear power. And we developed a program under Eisenhower called Atoms for Peace, and that overshadowed solar energy.
It seems like there must be some trail of lobbying involved here, too, though. I mean, it's often been pointed out that one of the reasons that renewable energy, like solar and wind, has a little difficulty in traction is because there's so much attention focused on and assistance given to the fossil fuel industry.
Precisely, and that's where, like I said, the book is primarily new. I found these documents. There was what I call Solargate. Under the Nixon administration, they developed an energy plan where all the money was focused on nuclear and fossil fuels, and they said this was vetted by the National Science Foundation. What they were keeping quiet was a huge report done by the National Science Foundation that said we should go with solar cells, and that if we spent the proper funding in the year 2000, solar cells would provide approximately 10% of America's electricity. However, the report that the Nixon administration did was by the Atomic Energy Commission, obviously biased, focused on breeders and focused on nuclear power. And they offered only paltry sums for solar cells, not the amount that the National Science Foundation said we needed to solarize America.
Oh, yeah, breeder reactors. I remember that story from the mid-70s. We never quite got there, did we?
Well, we never. Actually, ironically, today, at this moment, wind and solar produce more energy than all the nuclear power plants in America.
Really?
Yes.
Wind and solar together, more than all the nuclear power plants put together.
Exactly.
All right. On a sustained basis, though?
Or
is that peak output?
On a sustained basis.
All right.
You have to remember that's a hubris of humanity, is that we think of our plants that we build as being on a sustained basis, but San Onofre has not been producing a watt hour in the last 2 years. You're familiar with San Onofre, right?
Yes, in California.
Okay, it's been closed for 2 years now. It was a 2.2 gigawatt plant, and it's never going to be producing a single watt.
Because it will be shut down. Let us take some calls here. We have Jacob and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Perlin. His book is Let It Shine.
Yeah, I'm fascinated with your views of technology dating back 6,000 years, but I also want to broaden the discussion for the timeline of solar energy and widen the areas that we're considering, okay? Now, every square meter on this planet is populated by some type of photosynthetic organism, you know, whether algae in the sea or weeds on your lawn or even just grass on your lawn. And if you take all solar panels that man has ever invented and installed in, let's say, the last 100 years, they are dwarfed by the amount of the true photosynthetic, you know, genius of nature. You know, and nature is a major producer of solar, you know, energy and biomass and everything else. And if we, to shift gears just a little on timeline, every source of energy that we can use on this planet, whether wind, nuclear, coal, oil, geothermal, it's all derived from the sun. It depends on how far back you go. I mean, if we burn wood, that's solar from photosynthesis. If we burn coal or petroleum or natural gas, that's photosynthesis from, you know, dinosaur-era plants.
Many times removed, yes. Uh-huh.
That have been compressed and made into fuel. Geothermal and nuclear energy is derived from heating of the Earth's core from the sun for over billions of years. And wind is derived, if we took away the sun, we wouldn't have any winds to drive the windmills. So it's driven by changes of temperature on the planet that sort of causes convections and currents and winds. So what I'm saying is everything's derived from solar, you know, and it's not just the solar panel that we put on a building that we build. Every single square meter on this earth, unless man has built the building, and then maybe some of them thought green and put a solar panel on it, it would be a natural solar receptacle from photosynthesis, plants, weeds, grass, trees, whatever.
All right, interesting point. Thanks for that, Jacob. And go ahead, you jump in there, John.
Okay, I couldn't agree more, but there's a caveat in that the fact that the bearing of the bearing, you know, when the logs, the trunks of trees were buried, and they became coal, it brought down the CO2 and cooled the earth and made the earth livable for both animals, both for big and small. And now that we stupidly unearth those old, like, containers, you might say, of CO2 and burn them, we're creating a situation where animals, both big and small, including all of us, will not find the earth livable. So, no, I totally agree that earth has been, the plants have been fighting for photons for years, just like solar cells. But the beauty of the solar cell is they don't produce carbon. And so they stop this horrific and crazy global warming that the hot box in 1825 proved as real.
Let us take another call. Roger in Medford, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Perlin.
Well, good morning. I would like to offer just a personal perspective. I was in the solar industry in Colorado from 76 to 85, and there was an earlier question about where was the high point of the solar industry in the United States. I think it was then, and unfortunately in the Carter administration, there are some political, worldwide political things that happened that kind of shut him down and economic and issues that created some negatives as far as the world financial situation with the Arab oil embargoes of the early 70s. But you were talking about the political aspects, and when in what I consider to be the golden age of the last phase of the solar industry in the late 70s and early 80s, the Solar Energy Research Institute in Golden, Colorado, had an annual budget of $300 million during the Carter administration. When Reagan was elected, the first year he reduced that $300 million research budget of solar from $300 to $30 million. In the second year of the Reagan administration, it was reduced from $30 million to $3 million. And so there's got to be a political factor here that to what degree is it tied into the oil industry, to the fossil fuel industry, to, you know, lobbying? I'm not sure. But had the transition from Carter to Reagan, had Reagan would have been a supporter of the solar industry, we wouldn't be having the problems that we're having today with global warming, as far as I'm concerned.
All right, Roger, thanks for the perspective. Appreciate it. John? Yes.
I'd like to add to that. Once again, I totally agree with the caller. I just agree, right? What happened is the Reagan administration, it was a funny thing. They said, we have to go, you know, let the market rule. So cut all funding to solar, but because we already export lots of nuclear, we have to spend more on nuclear, right? And they said because we the coal industry needs our support, we have to support coal, and because oil is a big industry in America, we have to support oil. In fact, they changed the tax laws to make what's called the master limited partnership. As they cut the tax breaks for solar, they added tax breaks for fossil fuels. In fact, people who were like in solar in the government said they were shouting from the rooftops, the Germans are going to take over photovoltaics, the Japanese are going to take over photovoltaics as you cut our budgets, right? And indeed, this has come to pass.
All right, final call here. Pam and Dexter, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Perlin, the author of Let It Shine.
Hi, well, I'm a big fan of solar, and it's ridiculous that we don't subsidize solar, which is why I called, because I'm on a website right now called Capital Spill, and it says each year Congress provides between $10 and $52 billion to the oil, gas, and coal industries. And it's absolutely ridiculous that we're subsidizing the most wealthy industries in the history of humanity, which is destroying the planet, and when we're taking away help for the clean renewable energies, which are decentralized, which would be better if the grid went down. And it just shows to me, once again, how the lobbyists and money in politics is bribing our politicians to the demise of life on the planet, which it doesn't get much more basic than that. So I was wondering if you covered this in your book and what your comments are on the influence of the lobbyists and the fossil fuel industry on our legislators and why and what we can do to turn the tide. And, oh, and last night on Frontline, there was an excellent documentary on the Fukushima nuclear power plant and what went down. It's a real eye-opener.
All right, thanks, Pam.
Recommend people watch. I'll listen on the radio. Thanks.
Well, I couldn't agree more. In fact, one of the ironies is we call Solyndra a catastrophe, and we don't call something which is a catastrophe, Fukushima, a catastrophe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, we're at an inflection point where solar is becoming ubiquitous in the world and has grown from 360 kilowatts in 1976 to over 100 gigawatts today in the world, and is growing at a rate of about 40 to 50%. So we're at an inflection point where a lot of people are feeling very uncomfortable, like the utilities, because changing the whole paradigm from central to power generation to power generation on your roof. I mean, that's changing the world.
It's a big difference, and much to read there in the book, Let It Shine, the 6,000-year story of solar energy. John Perlin wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. John, thank you.
Thank you, Jeff, and I hope it went well.
Yeah, it did. Thanks for joining us. So again, tomorrow, or rather today at noon, Oregon Public Broadcasting's Think Out Loud is broadcasting live from Medford. We'll carry that program. I'll be on the panel. That'll take place of the second hour of Here and Now. So Think Out Loud today at noon here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. We'll return tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about World Film Week, the Oregon Main Street Project, and the Biodiversity Conference at Humboldt State. Reed Newland's our student assistant. Charlotte Duren's our producer. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening to the Jefferson Exchange, and have a great day.